Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, I'm going to deliberately talk slow here considering the technology, so please let me know if you have any trouble hearing me at any point. So may it please the court, I'd like to start with focusing on the questions you posed to me. The first being whether the court has jurisdiction to respond to the issues raised in appellant's motion for reconsideration because of the fact that appellant didn't specifically appeal that order. And I have to say we're essentially in agreement, although I think it's a moot point only because appellant raised issues about the sanctions and then also the trial court's dismissal of the of the entire case. And so I think although the court can't review it for abuse of discretion in regards to the motion for reconsideration, as I'll explain in discussing the other two issues, I don't think it's I think it's a moot point essentially. Secondly, the court had asked me to address whether the district court should have considered awarding sanctions against Luna's former counsel, my predecessor, rather than against Luna. And appellant essentially contends should not have been essentially required to micromanage her former counsel. I don't think we have a situation here where appellant wasn't complying with discovery orders. There's no type of Rule 11 sanction previously issued. Appellant shouldn't have essentially been required to supervise everything her prior lawyer did and seize control of the case at the first sign of potential misconduct. It would essentially be impossible for appellant to do that. The whole reason appellant hired a lawyer is to represent her in court, and he failed to do that. And I think essentially holding appellant responsible to such a duty would essentially require, it would cause plaintiffs to be reluctant to sue and also discourage defendants from vigorously defending themselves.
Mr. Mogan, yes. Rule 37D explicitly states that the court can award sanctions against the party, the party's attorney, or both. So that is contemplated within the language of the rule. Do you agree that any objection or argument that the sanctions should have been awarded against the attorney rather than the party was not made at the district court and was not made in this court?
I don't believe that I raised it in the appeal. And then the rule definitely allows you to sanction a party's attorney or the party themselves. I just think the facts don't warrant it, even though that may have raised that issue on appeal. I'm asking the court to...
Wait a minute, I'm sorry. Can you be a little more clear in answering my question? Are you asserting that you raised this issue on appeal?
No, I don't believe so. I essentially, the appellant addressed that they weren't appropriate against the party, so Luna Distributing, so I don't believe they waived it. Did I specifically say that...
But wait a minute, did you argue that... I understand you were arguing against the sanctions order, but there's a lot of connotations to that and sort of wrinkles within that argument. There's a serious waiver issue here that I don't see this argument, that any fees, if they were awarded, should have been awarded against counsel rather than the party. I don't see that anywhere in the district court briefing or anywhere in the briefing before this court. So that's the first problem. Is waiver. And then the next issue is, we know what the rule says explicitly. Can you cite any authority that says it's an abuse of discretion for the district judge to award the fees against the party?
To your first question, yes, I don't believe at any point appellant said Craig should have been, former counsel should have been sanctioned instead of her. And not to belabor the point, we just said any type of sanction wasn't correct. I can't cite any specific case saying that a court abuses discretion in not doing so, you know, based on similar facts in this case, unfortunately. I'm just asking the court, essentially, that they're not appropriate against my client. And so whether the court wants to remand and ask sanctions be held against former counsel, that's entirely up to your discretion. And I can't say I raised in the appeal or at the trial court, to the best of my knowledge. So I don't want to say something that's incorrect.
So your argument on appeal, is it that the fees are unreasonable, or that there was that Stoley wasn't entitled to fees? I mean, is it an argument about entitlement to fees to begin with, or whether the fees that were actually awarded were just unreasonable?
I think essentially both. I think they were unreasonable because of the fact there was no essential warning that such a drastic dismissal of the entire case came. Prior counsel didn't respond to the summary judgment. I think the court could have gone ahead and waited to the hearing date and granted that motion. There was arguments made by respondents that the appellants failed to prosecute the case, and I don't think those were warranted by the facts in the law. There was no discovery orders that were violated. There were no motions to compel.
That sounds like an argument about entitlement to fees. Can you cite to me anywhere in your briefs where you said that the amount of fees actually awarded were unreasonable?
Well, we argued that the $85,000 was unreasonable in the appellate brief.
But where? I didn't see that anywhere. So can you tell me where it is?
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm working with like three computers here. At the very end, I believe the last argument we just said that.
But isn't that a last argument about the request for about $450,000 in fees for all of their fees?
Well, we brought up that fact that it was so inordinate that nothing should have been granted. But specifically, just because only the $85,000 was granted, we just said nothing was warranted. And essentially, the court granted it in full. And I probably would expect something like that is if we went to trial, if there was a from day one until the end of the trial, an award in that matter would be required. We just essentially had a summary judgment, motion that wasn't responded to, and a failure to prosecute dismissal. And so, yes, I think we just addressed it in total and essentially argued that it wasn't appropriate. There wasn't a pattern from day one of failure to prosecute, comply with the court's orders, et cetera, any type of contempt citation before I got involved. Does that answer your question?
Yes, Your Honor? Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Morgan, your time is running out, but I did want you did address in your opening brief, the motion to the district court's order granting the motion to dismiss or failure to prosecute, and that's properly before. So, do you have anything else to add to what was in your brief about why the district court may have abused its discretion in granting the motion to dismiss?
I just want to reiterate that it's prior counsel, for lack of a better term, was essentially an absentee landlord, and for whatever reason. And I think if you held the attorney responsible and if the trial court issued a sanction order, I think defendants would be, you know, made full in a rather quickly time.
You recognize, though, that the district court tried its best to get him to respond to the matters that were pending.
But it was just essentially he didn't respond to a motion for summary judgment in which the respondents filed an affidavit late supporting it. So if the trial court had granted that, we would have had ample avenues to appeal it. They repeatedly respondents stated that they didn't comply with discovery, et cetera. But I don't believe that's warranted by the record. If the facts warranted something of that, that's a whole different argument, but I don't think it's essentially appropriate.
Tell us in just a couple of sentences why the district court abused its discretion in granting the motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute.
Number one, there was no type of warning of such an extreme remedy. And secondly, the facts didn't warrant that there were discovery abuses, failure to comply with orders, any type of Rule 11 sanctions, any type of contempt citations.
All right. I'll give you a minute or two for rebuttal, but let's hear from the other side.
Okay, thank you.
Let's see, Ms.
Ms. Hugh?
Ms. Hugh?
Yes. Ms. Hugh, representing Stoley Group USA. Luna conceded in its argument that the court does not have jurisdiction regarding the August 27, 2019 order. However, Luna is incorrect that the issue is moot. Luna only appealed the court's orders dated April 11th, April 25th, and June 14th, denying its motion for reconsideration under Rule 61 on grounds of mistake, inadvertence, and excusable neglect, and imposing sanctions for vexatious conduct during discovery. Luna did not appeal the August 27th order, denying its second motion for reconsideration and relief. The second motion for reconsideration and relief presented entirely different facts and issues. In the second motion for reconsideration and relief, Luna sought relief under Rule 66 based on the inexcusable neglect of its counsel and health issues of its principal. It made a 60B1 motion based on judicial error and a 60B3 motion for fraud or misconduct by opposing counsel. Therefore, the court should no longer review these issues because Luna has essentially conceded that the court does not have jurisdiction regarding the August 27, 2019 order. Moving on to the issues of sanctions.
And before you get to that issue, which I'm interested in hearing from you on that point, a couple questions for you, if I may. The emails between Lytle and Luna suggest no fault on the part of the client. Would you agree?
I do not agree, Your Honor.
And why not?
We do not agree because the attorney's actions are typically chargeable to their client. Imposition of sanctions are warranted because the attorney's actions are typically chargeable to the client. The client voluntarily chose Mr. Lytle as its representative in the action, and the client cannot now avoid the consequences of the acts or omissions of this freely selected agent. Moreover, litigants are considered to have notice of all facts.
Can I ask you, I'm sorry to interrupt. You're reading very fast. Can I ask you to slow down a little bit, please? Thank you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Litigants are considered to have notice of all facts known to their lawyer agent and have a duty to keep track of the progress of their lawsuit.
Let me try my question again for you. And again, I apologize for interrupting. My question was, do you agree that the emails in the record between Lytle and Luna suggest no fault on the part of the client? And if you believe there is something that suggests that, can you point it out to me, please?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the client is at fault because the client was working as a paralegal for Mr. Lytle on this case. She was aware that the deadlines in this case had been missed. She claims to have drafted the Rule 26F report, which set forth the discovery and trial schedule for this case. She also claims that she drafted the responses to the discovery requests in this case, and that she knew that, and therefore the deadlines for discovery were on the discovery request. Therefore, she knew that by the close of discovery, that the discovery request had never been responded to. The client was also aware that there was a Rule 30D6 notice of deposition. She was aware that she said that she was unavailable and never sought to reschedule in the deposition. The client also was aware that Mr. Lytle never filed a response to the opposition, never filed a response to the summary judgment motion, yet never attempted to contact the court, never attempted to fire Mr. Lytle, She took no action to manage and monitor the case, even though as an experienced paralegal who has worked on 5 litigations with Mr. Lytle, and worked on this case and other cases, she had the knowledge and access to monitor the litigation and better manage it than most litigants.
And then what was the lawyer's role in all this? If it was her exclusive duty to manage the litigation, in fact, the district court admonished the lawyer for trying to blame the paralegal for something which there's no indication she was at fault for. And I will take another look at the email exchanges to see if they support what you just said. But let me move on to the next point, since you and I can't agree on that one, apparently. $85,000 strikes me as somewhat excessive for Rule 37D, and in particular for the facts of this case. That rule allows recovery only for expenses incurred because of the other side's failure to attend a deposition or respond to interrogatories. Certainly your request for much more than that and for all your fees wasn't warranted under any example or rule. How can we justify the award the district court made, especially because the district court made no analysis of your request? It simply rubber stamped it.
Your Honor, the court did not rubber stamp our request. In fact, Stoley Group requested all of its fees in connection with the lawsuit because it considered this to be an exceptional case under the Lanham Act because of the frivolity.
It rubber stamped your $85,000 was the point of my question.
Your Honor, we asked for $400,000. They gave us $85,000 in connection with the vexatious conduct during the course of discovery.
Is that a cross appeal in this case?
No, Your Honor.
So my question dealt with the $85,000. Can you answer that one, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The court expressly reviewed and considered the nature of the services, the amount of time spent, and the attorney's hourly rate. In its order, it sufficiently detailed the total number of hours spent, the scope of the work, the specific tasks that were performed in connection, and it provided the supporting evidence that it relied upon. The district court also conceded the reasonableness of the attorney's fees. Therefore, the court did have sufficient basis to award the $85,000 in attorney's fees.
Thank you.
So, Ms.
Do you agree with me, since I've got your attention for a moment, do you agree with me that this court can consider issues that are not raised on appeal, that there is some authority, Ninth Circuit authority, that although the court has discretion, it can use it depending on the case and the facts of the case? Do you agree with that?
Well, Your Honor, I do not agree.
Yes or no, and then you may explain, please. Yes or no, and then you may explain.
I believe that the court can review issues that were not raised in connection with the order, the court's orders dated April 11th, April 25th, and June 14th that were noticed on the notice of appeal. However, the court does not have the jurisdiction to consider issues raised in the court's August 27th order.
So, Ms. Hugh, I have a question for you. The sanctions award, does that include any portion of the fees that Stoley asserts it incurred in filing the motion for summary judgment? And how did you separate it out? Or did you? Did you separate out fees incurred for preparing the motion for summary judgment versus fees incurred for alleged failures in discovery, to respond to discovery?
Yes, the request for sanctions, we did request some of the fees in connection with preparing the Rule 37D. We attempted to separate it out by separating out in our descriptions which of our fees were made in connection with the summary judgment motion, as opposed to which of our fees were made in connection with the rule for the motion to dismiss.
So, are you saying that you presented the district court with a breakout of fees and specifically listed which were related to discovery?
For summary judgment?
The district court denied it as moot. The district court instead granted the motion for failure to prosecute, to dismiss based on failure to prosecute.
Ms. Hugh, this is Judge Paez. So on the motion to dismiss, when the district court opted to take that route instead of granting the motion for summary judgment or ruling on the motion for summary judgment, did the district court seriously consider other alternatives that would have been less drastic than the ultimate sanction or disposition of dismissing the case for failure to prosecute?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that the district court did. In fact, in this order, the district court noted that it had given Luna multiple opportunities, that Luna had missed various deadlines as well as court conferences, and that the court had given Luna various opportunities to rectify these deficiencies,
It was my experience when I used to do this was, I'd try monetary sanctions first against the lawyer. See if that catches the lawyer's attention. That wasn't done here, was it?
No, it was not, Your Honor. However, the district court had permitted Luna to file a late-filed opposition to our first motion to dismiss, which was filed at the initial at the onset of the case. The district court also did not sanction Luna, even though Luna missed an earlier status conference with the district court. And Luna had missed, in addition, so the district court felt that it had given Luna multiple opportunities. It had chastened Luna's counsel for missing the status conference, and yet it did not, the district court felt that that these opportunities that it provided Luna, if Luna still continued to miss deadlines and to fail to prosecute the case.
Well, I don't quarrel with that. There was no the judge was very patient, I would say, with Mr. Lytle. But he ultimately just went right to dismissal, rather than imposing some monetary sanctions against Mr. Lytle. Isn't that right?
Your Honor, Luna had also never responded to any of our discovery requests, some of which were served in November of 2019. The case was, I believe, supposed to be trial ready by June. And,
did you file a motion to compel? Did you file a motion to compel responses and sanctions?
We did not, Your Honor.
Why not?
We filed requests for admissions, and Luna never responded to the request for admissions, and so all of the facts in the request for admissions were deemed admitted. On that basis, we could rely on those admissions as one of the bases for our motion for summary judgment.
Okay. All right. I believe Ms. Chang wanted to say something for 1 minute.
Your Honor, I'm fine.
Okay. All right.
If possible, Your Honor, could we save a 1 minute for any SIR rebuttal?
No, there's no SIR rebuttal. So, Mr. Mogan.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll take less than a few minutes you mentioned, and you can cut me off at any point. As you mentioned, as far as the court's sanction award not being specifically the result of the motion for summary judgment, discovery, and dismissal, I think the court didn't even rule on the summary judgment motion, and so I don't think it's appropriate to sanction my party or even Luna's counsel, because the court never even ruled on that. Respondents mentioned not responding to discovery, and that's to their benefit that the requests for admissions were deemed admitted. And so I don't believe that the failure to prosecute, warning any type of fees. And as the court mentioned, there's no motion to compel. There was no violation of a court order. Did prior counsel not pursue as much discovery at various points? Yes, but discovery may be permitted. It's not mandatory. And as far as prior counsel missing a status conference, I don't think that can be attributed to my client. A court should have sanctioned counsel, and what happened is he received a warning. And I just want to reiterate, some sort of monetary sanction, a warning with short notice that the whole entire case is going to be dismissed. The trial court obviously was aware that Luna replaced their counsel, as quick as possible after things deteriorated. And I just think that shows a willingness to prosecute. And I thank you all for
Mr. Mogan, this is Judge Beatty. I have a question for you. There's been some discussion about whether one of the clients, one of the principals of the client, Luna, acted as a paralegal for Mr. Lytle. And I saw in the record that when he missed the status conference, he said that his paralegal didn't calendar it properly. And then later he said his paralegal left him. Are we talking about the same individuals, or did he have different staff? Did he have a different person he called his paralegal versus his client?
So I don't want to misspeak because I came in the case at the very end, but I do know Mr. Lytle had other employees, and then I don't think Tammy Donald is the same paralegal he's talking about, to the best of my knowledge. And so it wasn't that Tammy didn't notify him. I honestly don't think to call it excuse out of a lack of better term, I don't even honestly think that's credibility, because if you look further on, he missed the summary judgment response. He didn't respond to the motion to dismiss the entire case. And so I just think that, I don't know his credibility, even for blaming his paralegal is warranted. But and I want to reiterate, a paralegal isn't an officer of the court. Luna hired him to represent him, and she didn't go pro se, so I don't think you can hold a paralegal of the same standard you would myself or any attorney. If an attorney drops the ball, you have the option to sue someone for malpractice. But I think if the court were to, which I don't know respondents would disagree with, if the court sanctioned Mr. Lytle, and at least for the final motion to dismiss the whole case, that is more appropriate than holding Luna responsible. And thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mogan. And thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We appreciate it. Matter is submitted at this time, and we'll take just a short recess while we tee up the next case.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.